Hey everyone, this is Andrew Sims from MuggleNet.com and host of MuggleNet's weekly podcast, MuggleCast. On Saturday, October 22nd, various media from around the Harry Potter community were invited to a junket conference with the actors of the Harry Potter films, including Dan Radcliffe, Emma Watson, and Rupert Grint. This first interview is with Goblet of Fire producer David Heyman and director Mike Newell, followed by an interview with the Triwizard Contenders and the actress who plays Cho Chang. The third and final interview is with the trio. Enjoy.
So, good afternoon, everybody, here in London. And for those of us joining us by phone from North America, good morning to all of you. Our first press conference will last approximately 30 minutes with director Mike Newell and producer David Heyman, and with that, we shall welcome them to the dais. Okay, so as I mentioned, we'd like all questions from the audience here to come via the microphone so the people back joining us on phone from North America so that they can hear, so we'll wait just a minute for some tape recorders to be placed.
How are you all? Very nice to see you.
Thank you for being here.
Yes. If you weren't here, then who would we be?
We'd be in trouble.
We'd be in a lot of trouble.
Hi, Stephen Schaefer here from Boston Globe. I wanted to ask both Mike and David, how is this Harry Potter different from everything that's gone before that? Everything's about to change on the posters for the movie. They've obviously hit adolescents that are growing up before.
What's the real dramatic difference in this one?
What do you want to do?
I can go.
You go. For me, it is that I think in the previous films, because of the age of the people, the age is crucial. What's been happening is that the scale of the challenge to the leading character has been limited. He's had a basilisk to deal with, he's had this problem, that problem, but he's never actually been challenged in his self. He's never had to put up or shut up. He's always had the group to rely on. And now in this one, he's older, he's more conscious, so he knows much more what's happening to him, and he knows when Voldemort says in the graveyard, come out here, what do you want? Do you want to take it in the back or do you want to take it in the front? But you're going to get it whichever way. And what Harry says is, all right, I'll show you. And he comes out and he's ready for a fight. And he knows that it's a fight to the death. He knows, and he has the moral courage to do it. So for me, the difference is, and of course there are lots and lots of wonderful new things about this, like the jokes and growing up and girls and, oh God, how do we dance and all of those things. But the big difference is that the challenge is kind of a moral one, and he may not survive it.
And for Harry, I think when we went to Jo the first time, it was sort of a very important thing for her that. And I think it's a theme it will continue, which is to stand up and be counted. Is that even if you might not win, rather you have to stand up for what you believe in.
Joe Rowling. It was a very, very important time for that. David took me up there 2 years ago now, and she talked about just that. She talked about these moral challenge, and she was brilliant about it, and I took a great deal away from that.
And that's really the fundamental, sort of the essence that Mike, sort of took from, that goes from beginning right the way through to the end, and it is a thriller. I mean, another change, it is a thriller. The world has expanded. We've got two new schools coming in. We have the first interaction with the opposite sex, and both the good and the awkward and uncomfortable sides of that that begin at 13, 14 and never go away. But it's hard, as Mike says, is this moral development. Harry is now 14. He's much more of an individual than he's ever been before. He's becoming more who he is.
It's terribly interesting.
And he's always grooming him to be.
Both you and I are taking Emma as a sort of honorary boy. But of course, Emma now gets to be, she gets to be a young woman, which is something that I personally am very proud of, because I thought that she was wonderfully, she allowed herself to be very vulnerable. She could so easily have said, well, I'm a Hermione and I'm going to be this and that, but she was very, very allowing of vulnerability and not knowing and not being kind of cool. I was very pleased at that, because I thought we got, just as in number three, there's this hugely satisfying moment where she hits Malfoy, bop. So there is in this one, there is this wonderful moment where she's unsure and insecure. And
the other thing is, I think that, you know, Mike is, you know, I think the kids, frankly, are growing as actors, and Mike is benefiting from having, you know, them having had two films with Chris and one film with Alfonso. But at the same time, one of the real reasons, one of the many reasons that Mike we brought Mike in was because he's one of the great directors and actors, and the kids are challenged. I mean, you know, he didn't let them rest one minute on what felt comfortable. You know, he pushed and pushed and pushed, and I think the performances show it.
Mike, talking about challenges, as a director, what is the challenge? You've got some of the greatest actors in England, the co-stars, about trying to use them. I mean, they're just becoming background now to Harry's story. I was wondering.
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's actually a problem. I think that the way that we attacked it was that even though each of them is now, Maggie's established, Alan's established, Mike Gambon, Hagrid, all these people are established, and so there's no more exploration for the audience to do of those characters. Indeed, they mustn't change in a way. And so what you have to do is to find a kind of lapidary way of using these tiny little bits which will show you parts of these characters that you've never seen before. And so you've never seen Hagrid before. And a very wonderful thing it is, too. She did this thing at rehearsal. Nobody could believe it. This is Francis de la Tour. And they found themselves opposite one another. And, of course, they're both of them great natural comedians. And so it was wonderful seeing these two people be kind of awkward and blushing and retiring with one another. And then suddenly she leant forward and does what she actually does in the scene, in the movie. She picked something out of his beard, and we all thought, isn't that wonderful? And then, God help us, she ate it. So, you know, those little things, a tiny moment like that will keep those characters alive. But yes, it's something you have to, it's difficult.
You also look at what you know, how Dumbledore in particular has really changed, and you know, beginning to explore. This is the first time that we're aware that things are getting beyond his control, and that he's not altogether comfortable with it.
Yes, it was really interesting that actually, because Michael was very game in that. I think that he had not wanted to be the same figure that Richard Harris had been, who is a figure of tremendous Olympian authority, who's never caught on the hop. He wanted something different too, simply because he wasn't Richard Harris. And what he found in this one was that Dumbledore is fallible and not omnipotent, and indeed is behind the game, and a great deal of what he does is about being inadequate rather than super adequate, which of course is much more interesting to play.
This is Gabriel De Lerma, Latin Publications, Los Angeles. It's a question for Mike. How much awareness did you have about the movies and the books? Have you read them? Have you watched the previous films before being approached for this?
Before being approached?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'd seen both the films. I'd read one book, the first book, and I'd seen both the films before I was approached, and so I was hoping to be approached. And was therefore educated pretty reasonably when I was approached. But then, of course, I started to particularly watch the films obsessively, and I can still my sleep as textual analysis on numbers 1, 2, and 3.
Alfonso was very generous.
Yeah, he was actually. As I'm sure, with Chris have been.
As Mike has been in turn with David Yates, and Alfonso allowed you know engaged Mike in discussions about the process and visual effects, and allowed him to see the film early, and just as Mike did with David Yates. I mean, David Yates has seen a rough cut of the film, so yeah. It's been really great in that way. By the way, Mike was one of the people, and in fact, Mike was I think maybe the very first person who I approached for the first Harry Potter. So I wanted him from the very beginning.
What a fool. This movie is so different from the previous one. Do you think that it's not only a kid movie anymore?
It isn't for me. Not a kid movie for me. It's an adventure story, and it's a huge entertainment. Warner Brothers absolutely hate me saying this, so I'm going to say it. But for me, it was it had all the kind of variety that a Bollywood movie has. It's just, it's like, oh, no, he said it! But anyway, it's a huge, broad-based entertainment. But above everything else, David is habitually very modest about this stuff, but he was very, very good when he first approached me, because what he said was, you must read the book, and if you find a way of doing the book, then you must tell us what that is. You mustn't come because it's a franchise. You mustn't come because it's the most famous children's film there's ever been. You mustn't come for this, that, and the other reason. You've got to be able to see how to make a 750-page book into a single movie. And we then had one of the meetings made in heaven, where we talked about the thing as being a thriller, because that's what I found in it. I thought that it was an absolutely God-given thriller. And then I convinced him.
I mean, for me, the books are not children's books. I think that's a misconception. I think the books are books that appeal to, maybe you could say, children of all ages, but I think they appeal to people of all ages. I think that they are, you know, there is something for everybody in them, and I think that this film, you know, each of the books is more mature than the one that precedes it, because it's also dealing with a different age, a different year in Harry's life. In this one, Harry's 14. So there's different issues, there's greater complexity, I think that really shows in the film, because the film is true to that spirit. The other thing is when you bring in a director like Mike Newell, just when you bring in a director like Alfonso Cuarón, you don't want to. They're not their directors. They are not cookie cutters. You don't bring in a director like Mike Newell and tell him, well, you've got to make a film just like Chris Columbus. I mean, it would be foolish. So for me, it's been one of the... I look at this film, I see Mike Newell, I mean, I see Joe Rowling, but I see Mike Newell written all over it, and that's really exciting to me. I saw Alfonso written all over it, and Chris,
yes,
too.
Yes, I saw that with Alfonso and Chris.
And I think it's really important, and I hope that David Yates, I'm sure that David Yates will imbue the fifth with the same. And it's really exciting to me. This is a big, generous, smart, funny thriller.
Were you happy with the
PG-13? Very much so. And I'm very happy with the 12A in the UK. I see, you know, if we... Yes, one, I think that it'll be good for the slightly older audience. And two, I think that we had to be... It shows that we've been faithful to the material. I think if we can't... Books do not talk down to an audience. The audience reaches for the books. And I think the films do the same. We don't patronize our audience. We make films. Mike's films very much in the spirit. It's not literally faithful, but it is truly faithful to the spirit of what Joe has written, and that's really exciting me.
One of the challenges was that Of course, everything goes back to the book always, and that's where the audience begins as well. And so as the audience, which began with the first book, progresses through 2 and 3, they get to 4, and they see that it's a different kind of an animal. It's a much tougher beast than the others. And if you don't get a PG-13 in a way, then that audience that began with number 1 and is now 14, 15, 16, or 64, whatever, will kind of want to know why you are still, are you not infantilizing the situation? Of course, what David says is that these are not children's books. These are kind of adult stories with a very strong moral aim in view. So with PG-13, they can believe. Without, I'm not sure they can.
Sorry. Mike, in this stage of your career, after all these remarkable films, how does this rank personally, the whole, not only the film, but the whole entire project?
Okay. So I always hate what I make. I think that it simply shows a depth of lack of I truly mean this. This sounds like sort of, you know, jokes in front of, but it isn't. I can't stand myself sometimes. He's seen me in rushes where I simply can't bear the ordinariness of what I do. And I always feel that about
everyone. Even when it's extraordinary, by the way.
What's that?
Even when it's extraordinary, you go,
oh, I can't. Anyway, but I really do. And I always hate the end result. And this time, and it may be a very bad sign, I don't know, but this time I don't hate it. This time I think it's what I tried to do, what we all tried to do, which was to make this wonderful, terrifying thriller ride. And so it pleases me very much, and that's a better way of answering your question than I know how.
And by the way, no, we didn't. To answer your question, Pardon.
No.
David, this question is for you. I wanted to ask you, in working with Mike, bringing Mike on board, he brings a certain British sensibility to it, and I was wondering, from your perspective, can you talk a little bit about that Britishism that he brought to the film?
Absolutely. I think Mike went to a school, as did I, by the way, just like Hogwarts, but without the magic.
Yes, actually, our two schools were very close, yeah. Very similar.
And so he brings an innate understanding of the school life. He is very comfortable getting on the floor and wrestling with the kids to bring the, as he did with the Weasley twins, to bring sort of verisimilitude to that moment. The school is more anarchic than I feel that it's been in any of the other films. It's a little more anarchic. It's a little madder and a little looser. Yes, you have the authority of the teachers, but you also have the kids, you know, rebelling as kids do, kids standing up for themselves, kids, you know, complaining to teachers. And I think Mike brings a real, I think that's very true to the schools, the school that I went to, and I think it's true to school life in general, but it's most certainly true to British schools. I also think that in a way, I think the nature of the performances, there's an intangible thing that I don't know quite how to describe, but I really feel that the performances in this are more British than they've ever been. I feel that there's a complexity and a at times, and when he talks about Bollywood, a theatrical, you know, a largeness in a really positive way to the performances. And by the way, I think Dan is incredibly subtle and nuanced, and I think all the performances are. But it's a boldness about the performances, which I think is very, 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 very British, and I'm very happy for that.
We have time for 2 more questions at this end, and then we'll have the final question.
You've talked a bit about how the characters have evolved, sort of the kids, how they've grown up and handled, you know, becoming teenagers. Can you talk a bit about how the actors themselves are handling the fame and how they're sort of dealing with growing up really on set and in front of the whole world?
My goodness. Yeah, I have a crack at that. I'm not sure.
How did you find them when they arrived?
Like Michael.
No, people like Dan, Rupert, and Emma in particular.
Oh, I mean, I had been expecting. My worst fear was that they would have realized that these films were stories in which they absolutely were the stars. Now, most children's films, that's not true of. Most children's films, they are a sort of little bolt-on of a third of the story, while the weight is still taken by the adults. In that way, Mary Poppins is not quite a children's story. It's an adult story. But that's not the case here. This is a story in which the children are stars, and that can do terrible things to children. And miraculously, mostly because of the way they're handled by the production, and also because they've got very good parents, good kids, good parents, they haven't. They know exactly what they are worth, but they have not become impossible. And so they're still loose, and they're still curious, and they are still prepared to have a go at anything. We had before we began shooting, we had 2 weeks of acting classes. And the reason that we did this was that I was very anxious that the established characters would not dominate the newcomers, many of whom had never acted before. The Chinese girl never acted before. The two little Indian girls never acted before. And I didn't want them feeling that they were secondary citizens. And so we had these 2 weeks where what we did was we played, we did physical exercises, we did improvisational exercises, so on and so forth. And by the end of that, everybody was loose in one another's company, and there was no rank structure. It wasn't that Dan outshone anybody else. They were all the same. And they were prepared to do that, which is a very wonderful thing. And it shows. What you've got now is an ensemble rather than a top-down pyramid structure. You have an ensemble.
And I think in this film, more than the previous three films, partly because of the number of the cast and the number of extras. I mean, the number of extras in this film was, larger than any of the previous films. But it was more than any of the other films. There was the sense of a community amongst the kids. And, whether you've got Stan who plays Crumb they all were playing and joking and laughing, and there was a lot more hanging out. And I think it also gave a real, Dan and Rupert, they were all part of that. And so it's a much more extended community, more like school life than I think it's ever been.
That's a good point, actually. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. It was much more like the kind of loose relationships that you would build up in school, much bigger.
Yeah, and they come to, and I have to say, we are blessed. I mean, the three kids who could, so as Mike said, so easily be brats are not. They want to learn. They want to get better at what they do. They are enthusiastic still, and they have a lot of fun doing it. And, I think partly the rehearsal that Mike had them do, but also by the very nature, they are non-judgmental, open people who are as good to the person who, they're good to people from the top down. It's not. I think Mike will attest to this, though the buck always stops with him. Ultimately, it's a very democratic environment. It's a one in which people, everybody has a voice. Sometimes too much one, but everybody has a voice.
No, I agree. I agree. The trouble is you can't start to play that game unless you play that game all the way through.
I agree with you. It's a very democratic. It's a place in which everybody is welcome, and it's not a place in which it's a very open door. Very safe place for kids to be.
Can I quickly tell them about the fight?
Yes.
Well, there had to be a fight at one point between the two Weasley twins, and they did horrible adolescent
stage screen fighting. It just wasn't. It was awful. And I tried again, and I pushed them, and I pushed them. They still couldn't get past it. And I said, okay, which one of you wants to fight me? And they were like rabbits in the headlight. I said what they thought I'd said. And finally, one of them put their hands up. And so we fell upon one another, and we rolled over and over and over on the floor of the Great Hall until I actually cracked a rib. And it was very early on in the shooting schedule, and all the kids were there, and they all saw the director make a complete prat of himself and also get himself injured. Ha, ha, ha. And things were a lot easier after that, actually. You know, it doesn't do any harm to puncture dignity.
And we have time for one more question here, and then we'll go to the
film. Okay? Matthew Vines from BaredToSerum.com. This question is for Mr. Newell. How frequently did you consult with J.K. Rowling about deviations from the book and subplots cut from the storyline, and what about in particular?
Well, I'll answer it, but you should also ask David, because this is an absolutely key function of David's. J.K. Rowling appears to me to be quite extraordinarily hands-off. Everybody says, oh, we're surprised to hear that. We thought that she was very controlling. Well, I speak as I find. She wasn't with me. And I don't think it's in her nature. I don't think she's like that. David's relationship with her, which is very close, meant that the whole time, the script, as it evolved, and the script continued. Did you know I had a set of script pages 5 days ago? We finished shooting the film 6 months ago. I had a set of script pages.
David Baron, the lamp, he said to Michael, and I said, what is this? He said, oh, yes, we shot them yesterday. and they were great.
That's right, they were great, yes. I don't know what color they were. I sort of enjoyed that, sorry. But, of course, what happened?
Once again, if you wish to ask a question, to press *1 at this time.
Huge tribute to David. It's an enormous tribute to Steve Clovis that, in fact, they could, both of them and everybody around them, could be loose enough to see that actually we might be going to a place, although we couldn't exactly point to it on a map yet, but we might be going to a place which wasn't exactly where the first draft of the script had started out. But of course, in that, the danger is that you lose Joe Rowling, at which point you lose the audience, because they come in the end for her. She was very, very sweet. She was very available. She's not the best returner of a phone call that I've come across, but she was fine. She gave me very clear things when I needed them, like what did the Avada Kedavra curse actually do when it hits you. But she also had this very strong view of how the story fitted into this seven book arc. Beyond that, she didn't control at all, but of course it was to David's credit that she was brought in to the process just as much as he knew she wanted to be, and not an inch more. I mean, how does that work?
Joe is the most generous of collaborators. She sees each and every draft of the screenplay. We want to do that because, one, I made a promise at the beginning that I would be that we would be true, but two, because we would be fooled to be otherwise. And she... So we show her each draft, and we also don't want to do anything that will disrupt books. At that time, 6 hadn't been published, or book 7. We didn't want to do anything that would adversely affect that, or that would make people read them askance, or look at them askance. So she has incredible knowledge. I mean, what's in the books is just the surface of what she knows. She has notebook upon notebook with more material that doesn't fight as the books. But I think one of the reasons for the success of the books is because the universe is so clearly thought through. And you know, she knows, I think I said this before, she knows the 6 years of dragon's blood. You can have a question, she knows the answer. There was one, for example, very significant change that we made. And we called Joe to ask her about it because it was amazing. I mean, we would have done it anyway, but it was major, and it had to do with Barty Crouch Jr. being present in that very first scene in the film with Voldemort and Peter Pettigrew, which isn't in the book. The scene takes place, but Barty Crouch Jr. is not in it. And the reason why we wanted that was because we needed Barty Crouch Jr. to be a more recognizable and formidable presence when you got to the end, when Moody turns back into him. And without that, the only time you'd have seen him would have been in a flashback when he didn't look exactly like he did at the end. So I called Joe and asked her about it, and she said, yeah, that could have happened. That's absolutely fine. What she loved about the third film, she hasn't yet seen the fourth, but what she loved about the third film was because it was that it was true to the spirit, that it made changes, but it made changes in the spirit of the work. That's what she has felt so far in the process of the inclusive process of the script, and I know she'll feel when she sees the film. You know, she was meant to see it last week, but some personal matters came up, and then she couldn't. She will be seeing it shortly.
Great. I'm sorry on that note. I've got to pitch it to the phone. People have been offered very patient.
No interest.
So we have time for two questions.
That'll be nothing.
She has the attitude that says the book is the book, the film is the film, and you won't make a good film unless you have a certain amount of freedom.
Sorry. Okay. Operator?
Yes. The first question comes from the line of Steve Bryan of Suburban Journals. Please go ahead.
Good evening. I'm directing this towards Mike. This is one film where you have to put Daniel through all his paces, lots of running and jumping. How did he handle that?
Well, he's a very brave boy. He really is a brave boy. He's a rotten swimmer, or he was when this began. And he had great trepidation and came to me about the swimming. There wasn't any way around it. He had to swim. He had to spend huge amounts of time underwater in the tank. And apart from anything else, he was by no means sure that he had the physical resources to do that. You couldn't say that he was frightened of it, but it was only a step away. And nonetheless, he knuckled down and he did what he had to do. There was another shot that I was actually there for, and I could see that he was absolutely terrified that he had to do it.
That was the one falling off the
sliding down the roof. Have you seen the movie? No. The man who's talking to me. Have you seen the movie?
I have seen all the trailers.
Okay. I think it may be in the trailers. There's a shot anyway when during the dragon chase, he's knocked off his broom and he slides down a very steep roof, which he did for real. So he slid 30 feet from a 40-foot high gantry with a safety wire on, of course, but nonetheless. But nobody had to say, sorry, Dan, but you've got to do it. We would ultimately, of course, have said that, but nobody had to say that because he will read himself the riot act. He will tell himself what he's got to do. So I don't think that he's naturally, he's not going to turn into a stuntman, but he is. He's a very responsible boy. He knows what he must do, and he simply does it.
Actually, on the first film, when we began the process, Dan was not a physical boy, and he wanted to be more physical, and actually we encouraged that, and we put him together with our stunt team, and he is now a jock of sorts. I mean, his body has changed. He's really much more physical than he ever was, and he, you know, at lunch break, for example, several times a week, he'll go down to the gym and work out. It's not something we're actually asking him to do. He just loves to do it. At times, he likes to do his own stunts. He's very brave, as Mike said. In the underwater scene, he logged 41 hours on his logbook.
Okay. Sorry, time for one more question from operator.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Daniel Feinberg of Zaptua.com. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. This question is probably more for David, but also for Mike. Could you guys talk a little bit about the impact of Steve Clovis and the continuity of the series, and then sort of as a quick follow-up, is Imelda Staunton signed on to the next movie?
You broke up quite severely towards the end there. Could you just briefly say the question again?
The first and main question is about the role of Stephen Clovis in the continuity of the series, and then sort of the quick follow-up, just wanted to know if Imelda Staunton is signed on to the next movie as rumored.
Steve Clovis, Steve Clovis is one of the great experiences to me, of one of the great joys of this entire series has been working with Steve Clovis, and frankly he's becoming a very good friend over the 5 years. I think he's one of the best writers writing. He is a brilliant adapter in the sense that he's able to retain the voice of the author that he's adapting. He did it with Michael Chabon, The Wonder Boys. He did it with another script I read called Shockproof Sydney Escape, and I think he's done it in the four horror films that he's written. He is a fantastic writer who manages to bring who has a keen sense of character and really understands the voice of the actors he is writing for. And it also, he can write with great emotion and at the same time also great humor. He is not doing the fifth because he is writing another project for me called Curious Incident of the Dog at the Time, which I hope he will direct. However, he read the sixth book and couldn't stay away, and so he's going to come back and write the sixth.
Oh, great! That is good.
Yeah, no, it's great. Michael Goldenberg is writing the fifth. He is another writer who actually I talked to about the first film, and he's doing a fantastic job. You know, with a bad, you can never make a good film out of a bad script. You most certainly can make a bad one out of a good one. But the key is to have a good script, and I really believe that Steve Clovis, on each of the four films, has given us a really good script. He's also a man, and Mike can speak to this a little bit, who writes without ego. He's someone who, it's great when you sit in the script meeting with him because you can say anything, and he's thought through everything. And you know, it doesn't mean that he doesn't defend what he has, but he does it in a way which explains what the reason why he has done what he has done, but is always open to changes. He also has an encyclopedic knowledge of the world, and clearly he and Joe are very much on the same wavelength.
Okay, thank you all very much.
Everything he said, and it was the most, it was the happiest collaboration I think I've ever had, certainly as an adapter. And he never gets in your way. I am one of those who will, I will stuff written and rewritten and rewritten right the way through the film, which is why the joke about getting pages 6 months in shooting, why we all laugh at that. But he would never, ever complain. He would always see why, and he would always dig down into his personal mine of stuff and come up with wonderful things. I can't tell you how happy I was with him.
Great. Thank you all very much. For those on the phone, the next press conference will be starting in less than 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Katie.
Robert.
Clemence, please.
Daniel Mesky. Good afternoon. I'd like to know, did you feel like strangers when you came on the set, or everything was like a real crowd of friends, or?
Who wants to start?
You can.
Okay. We've been welcomed very nicely. And everyone's been very, very friendly the first few days, and then it was just everyone in the same boat doing the same movie, so great.
Dan?
Well, there's not much to add. We were extremely warmly welcomed, and, you know, I personally felt at home right from the beginning, so.
For all of you, can you tell us how the audition process was? And I know that some of you were selected among a few thousand people.
My audition process is quite long-winded. My dad's an advert on telly, and basically just suggested that I should go down and try out for the part. And I haven't done any acting beforehand. I was a bit reluctant, but I went down anyway. And I stood in a queue for hours and hours. And I went in, and I finally got in, and they just took a Polaroid and said they'd call me back if they were interested. So I got a call a few weeks later, and they told me to go down for a drama workshop. And that involved a lot of improvisation and a few scenes from the movie that involved Harry and Cho. And then they called me back for a screen test, and that took place in Leavesden Studios, where they filmed the movies. And just from there, I got the part.
Yeah. So maybe Robert, maybe Dan, also
Jeff Lambert. You want to tell a little? Yeah, I have a very interesting story. I needed casting directors from another movie, which I did, and they wanted to see me for this part, but I was doing another movie over the casting period, so I ended up seeing Manuel and Marisol and Fiona Weir, who were casting at the time, before anyone else was seen for casting. And and then I went to do this other movie, and the day I came back, I got a call back, and basically what happened. It was called The Ring of the Nibelungs, which was a German movie.
Well, I've got an interesting story. I was basically spotted in a school. It was all a chance, really. I was late for my afternoon registration, which the school had. So you can imagine I was obviously a bit nervous and rushing through to sign in. But the casting director was there at the time with the head of drama in the school. So she heard me talking and obviously, you know, turned around, saw me, had some interest. Asked me to go to an audition later on in the school, which I went to dress up really sporty before going into the gym. So I was kept the longest, and I was asked to go to two workshops afterwards, which I didn't go to, you know, for various reasons. I had an exam, and then I think one of the times they let me out. So as any normal person would think, I thought, oh, well, he's lost his chances, you know, they're not going to call me back. But then I did get a call back, and they weren't very happy that I didn't go. So I went again, and later on I met Mike, and he turned out to like, and I got it.
My audition was much more classical than Stan's. I was working with a French casting director on something else, and he said, "Okay, I'm doing the Harry Potter casting. Would you like to come?" So we had a little chat in English in front of the camera, and then Mike was in Paris promoting Mona Lisa, so I met him in a hotel. We had a little chat, and then I think we were three left and all came to London to audition in a very short scene, and that was it.
With Harry?
Not with Harry, no.
Matthew Vines from VeritasTheorem.com. Could each of you describe a typical day on set?
Well, God, I don't know. There wasn't really any. I don't think there was any sort of structure. Like there would be days when hardly anything would happen, and you'd be waiting around all the time because it was such a long shoot. We were shooting for about 11 months or something in total, and so there were days and weeks where you just do absolutely nothing.
What part of it did you have to get up on the average day?
Because most people, I think you, a lot of people got to sort of, because of younger people working on it, I think most people worked from about 9 or something, but I generally start at 6:30 or something. You sort of end up generally starting work after lunch, after just having a little leisurely morning. But some days were just ridiculously busy, and other days, you know, especially when there's stunt work or something like that, they would go on and be a really long day. But, a lot of the time, just waiting around.
I was wondering if
you knew about the series beforehand, each of you, if you could just say a little about that. You've been reading the books, if you were fans of it. Also, if you quickly, and I know one of you can't answer, looked at the next book to see if you were in that one.
I was a fan of the films before, and I got the part, and I read the first three books. I didn't read the fourth and fifth one until after I got the part. And they're the books which Cho was more involved in. Yeah, mentioned really briefly, and I think Harry gets over to that too. Which is a shame.
I loved the books. I'd read the first four ones. I'd seen the first movie, and then I saw the third one on set, actually. And I absolutely, yeah, loved the whole universe and the whole world of Harry Potter.
Well, I haven't read the book or seen the film. But as soon as I got the book, I read the book up to the one. And I've touched the sixth one. And I saw the film. Yeah.
I hadn't read any of them either. I read the fourth one just before my audition, and read it in like a day or something. It changed my whole opinion about the whole series.
Okay, I wanted to ask if each of you could discuss your character, what you think, you know, what you think of them, and are you all signed for, you know, the rest of the series?
Well, Victor appears in the fourth book. You know, he's the world David Beckham, I would say, a player. So he's obviously, you know, well based in the magic world of Harry Potter. Well, people describe him as being very physical, although I think he's got two sides. Very, you know, very sporty, very concentrated, knowing what he's doing, but also, you know, he's got a big heart, and, you know, he develops feelings for Hermione and so on. So, yeah, I think he's a great character.
And where is he from, and why does he have an accent?
Well, he's from Bulgaria, and that's where his accent comes from.
And the
Pirat?
Yeah.
Flaudelacour, is French. I'm French. And she's the kind of girl that, you know, we've all read in our school. She's Miss Perfect. Kind of annoying at the end, being so perfect. But, you know, always well-dressed and, you know, good at sports, good at school, good at everything. So she appears like the kind of image that I guess people have of a French girl, and then react as a normal girl to what's happening. That's it.
Cedric is he's a prefect at Hogwarts. He's in the top year, and he's sort of just one of those guys who always wants to do the right thing, but not in an annoying way. He's like, it's impossible to hate him. Like, so, I think anyway. And he was good at sports and very athletic, and he kind of vaguely takes Harry under his wing, and they get closer as the film draws.
Have you seen
it
with
the
audience yet?
No, well, I'm not really. I've seen it with these guys yesterday.
My character Cho basically shows that Harry's developing into this teenager. And he's starting to, it's like a hormonal change, and he becomes interested in girls, and basically I'm his crush. Yeah.
So. Hi, Seth Rosling on USA Today. This question is more for Katie and Clement. When you've been reading the book, this is the first time we see Lord Voldemort. How does he compare to what you had thought in your imagination? And how do you think Ralph finds his characterization of that character? Do you think he sort of, you know, what do you think about him? You know,
how he portrayed the character?
I think he's done a great job. I mean, when I watched it yesterday, it was such a dark scene, and he's just really terrifying, which is, you know, what Voldemort is. I think he's made a great portrayal of the character, and he's exactly like I imagined him to be when I was reading the books.
I can't really remember what I imagined. I'm sure I imagined something, but I kind of lost the idea I had. And I loved that moment where, you know, he becomes real and that costume surrounding him and, you know, him becoming a man in a way. I thought it was great.
Katie and Stan, you hadn't acted before. What's been the impact of this on your life so far?
I don't think it's not really changed apart from the fact that I know I can act now. And also it has really brought out a lot of confidence in me, like being able to act in front of so many people, in front of cameras, and getting to meet new people as well. Interacting with everyone, it's everything's been positive about the film.
Pretty much the same. I've gained a lot of experience and a lot of confidence, especially being in front of you know, a group of people, even a crowd. I couldn't do that before. I was quite a nervous guy. But I've also found out what I want to do in the future, which is hopefully continue acting. So. Partly.
For each of you, I mean, this is probably your biggest film, if not your first film. And I was just wondering, are you guys prepared for the fame that would be entailed with this? Because you're going to be known all over the world. And how are you prepared to deal with fans?
It's strange. Somebody asked my autograph the other day, and because I finished school and I'm not really doing anything at the moment, I was just kind of aimlessly wandering around London, and these two guys who are about 30 or something came up and asked my autograph, and I kept sort of, because I had nothing, I was really like sort of, I was quite proud at the time and did it, and I was like, they wanted to take photos and stuff, and then they were sort of wandering around, and then I was kind of wandering around. I bumped into them like three times afterwards, and like every single time, their respect for me was just going and going and going. Just so you don't really do anything now, but you're famous. So I don't really know how it will affect me when it actually happens. So yeah, I don't know.
Well, I don't think you can actually really be prepared for. You know, what's really going to happen after this film comes out, because, you know, the fan base is worldwide and it's absolutely huge, so I guess we just have to face it and, you know, do our best.
You have that scene in the movie where your fans are
talking.
Yeah.
Okay. Like Robinson said, I don't think I'm going to be, like, no matter how much you try to prepare for it, you know, it's going to be beyond your expectations what's going to happen. I mean, this morning, like, when I was coming back to the hotel, there's a few, like, photographers and crazy fans outside. It was just terrifying, but at the same time, it's a really nice feeling as well. The fact they want your autograph and, like, it means something to them. I think it'll be a really good experience.
I don't know how you could prevent. I've never been recognized so far, and I think because I live in Paris, because I'm shooting other movies in Paris, yeah, it might be a bit easier for me than for you guys, because also the tabloids aren't that big in France.
But I don't know, I just, you know, I think when you walk in the street without makeup and in your jeans, because it has always been, well, I just hope it's going to stay the same.
Sorry, people. Clemence, you are fluently bilingual, and but you also have an ease with dialect in English, because you can also talk Americanese, so to speak. I'm just wondering where that comes from.
I've been a very lucky girl because my parents, I was in a school, my parents put me in school where you learn English a lot more than you would usually do in a normal French school. And I went on an exchange program to Toronto when I was 13, spent like 2 months there going to school, and you know, I had no choice but speaking English. And then, you know, it started from there, and then I've been working in England a bit, I've been working with Americans a bit, so each time, you know, it's another step, and you actually work on your accent and try to improve it. But it comes from, you know, back to when I was 13, I think.
Okay, we have time for one more question here, and then we'll go to the phone question. Matthew, I'm from VeritasTheorem.com. What stunts did you most enjoy doing?
Well, I personally enjoyed doing stunts with the water. I had a dive, which I think won't be seeing. I enjoyed that most because, you know, it took a lot of courage and a lot of time and a huge amount of effort, so I've enjoyed that most.
Well, the only stunt I have to do is all the underwater things, so I guess that's what I like the most.
The maze stuff was really, really fun to do because it was all real, and no one actually knew whether the walls, because it was all hydraulic walls, and no one actually knew if it would kill you or not, like if you actually got trapped there. So like it was quite nice to be sort of doing enforced method acting. Like, it was quite nice. It was really, really exciting, and like doing all the stuff with the weeds, like. It's just quite, it was so enclosed in the maze that like you could really let your imagination go, and even though it's just some guy with a rope pulling your leg, like it's still that you can just sort of scream. It's really fun. It's quite sort of therapeutic.
Well, I didn't take part in a lot of stunts, but the only thing I did was the underwater scene. I had to take diving license. That was a great experience. There's a lot of hard work, and but yeah, it was good.
Okay, so operator, are you there?
Yes.
Let's go with question one, please.
Okay, first question comes from the line of Michelle Riley, Harry Potter's page. Please go ahead.
Yes, for those of you who have dreams for how this.
Operator, we're getting a lot of feedback. We're hearing every third word.
Okay, one more, please.
For those of you who have experience filming before, how did you film from your outside?
Okay. Operator, can you say the question, please?
I'm getting the same sound you are.
Okay, let's jump to the next question. Sorry.
Turn the volume down on your mic in the room.
Okay. For those of you who have experience with filming before, how different was this film from the rest of your film?
It's almost a different job because everything's just 10 times bigger. Filming, you know, the filming time is, how long did we, I mean, I shot for like 8 months when I usually do 2 months. The crew is, you know, you don't know half of the crew you're working with. And you're actually not on set as much as you are on a normal movie. I mean, you've got doubles, everyone has doubles. You're on set when you have to do something. You're not participating as much, you know, to the life of the movie as you would do on a smaller budget movie. So it is a good way to approach that kind of movie, I think.
Yeah, this is the scale of it is completely different, and also things to do with with blue screen effects, and so I did some blue screen things in my last film, but just the difference, because they have such a huge budget, basically, you can, like, there's so much, virtually every scene has a bit of some sort of special effect in it, which is, it's strange to do, like, having to use your imagination so much.
Okay, operator, next question.
One moment. Press, please, go ahead.
Hi, this question is for Clement. I see you have a birthday coming up in November, so I just wondered, this is your first really big film. How do you plan to celebrate?
And my birthday isn't actually in November. I don't know. I saw it somewhere. It's not in November, so...
We need to
go to the holiday. I don't know. I think I'll give my birthday to myself. And I'm 23 now.
Okay.
Okay, the question at this end, operator, we'll come back to you in a minute. The question at this end is, how old are each of the actors here in the room? So we'll let them answer that first.
19.
18.
Okay, great. So operator, next question.
Next comes from the line of Andrew Sims of Muggle.net. Please go ahead.
Hey guys, I was wondering what kind of practice went into the Yule Ball scenes and how you think you did in the final cut.
It was cool. We practiced for like I think it was a 2-week choreography session, and learning a waltz and things like that. And it's cut down to actually nothing in the film, so like it's quite strange. But it was fun doing it. That was a really fun period. Like I've never really done Renaissance. Is it Renaissance or waltz? I don't know. Renaissance dance. Same classical dancing. I've never really been good at any form of dance. And the shoot was about two or three weeks. Yeah, and I think the most embarrassing part of that was just the normal dancing. When the rock band comes on, like, I think there was 2 days where you just had the choreographer was just like, just dance how you dance, like in a club or whatever. Like, that was really awkward.
Okay, we have time for one question from operator.
Yes. Okay, next question comes from the line of Melissa Nelly of Leaky Cauldron. Please go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering if you guys could switch roles with anybody else in the film, who would it be and why?
Switch parts.
I think I would love to play Ron's part, because he's like the comical guy, and he seems to like, he's able to make everyone laugh even at in the saddest times. I mean, it's like the film's like really tragic, and like stuff he comes out with is just hilarious. I'd love to make people laugh, because I can't do that in real life.
Robert? Probably Harry. I think I not being arrogant or anything, but I just think it's a really intricate, like, and it's an amazing part. And I think also when you don't really have the opportunity to be guaranteed 7 films when you're growing up during them as well, I think, like, it's really strange. Like, it's like, yeah, I think it's amazing. I think it would be an absolute, like, I think Daniel's doing it amazingly as well, and you can see him progressing and developing as an actor and as a person. It would be an interesting part to play.
Dumbledore has always been my favorite character, so I guess, you know, I'll switch to the beard and the weird dress.
I'll probably try out Voldemort. we've only just seen what he's actually like in a humanic way. And I would love to try and see what it feels like to be the Dark Lord.
Okay, thank you all. We are going to be bringing in Daniel, Emma, and Rupert momentarily, so if you want to switch tape recorders real quickly or anything, thank you very much. And for those on the phone, we'll just have a moment.
Hi, you guys. Cindy Perlman from the Chicago Sun-Times.
Hello.
And congratulations. This was one of the great Harry Potter movies.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I wanted to know what you thought about him growing up. Was it something you guys have identified with a little bit in your own lives? And what do you think about your character's aging?
Well, I mean... How close to that? Right, okay. It's... I think for me, it's great because... You know, there's so much pressure on the films now to get better and better and better and better. And especially after the third one, which, for me, was great. And there was an awareness that we had to work really hard to go further with it and to make it better, because otherwise people would be very disappointed, I think. And so, for me, it is also a lot of fun. Sorry, I've been giving mints, I think. It's also loads of fun playing Harry as he's getting older, because it's almost as if, sort of, when you go from being... You know, I think when we start, Harry's 10. It's his 10th birthday, and it's almost as if in real life, not just in the stories, but you know, people sort of grow extra emotions. You know, which is partly to do with hormones and all the trouble that they cause, and then partly just a thing about growing up. You have other assets to you, and so it's fun playing that in Harry as he grows older.
I think there's been a lot of speculation about whether we're going to outgrow our parts or that the films will take longer than we will, but actually it works out really well because each film takes about a year. Obviously that coincides with us doing our year at school, so we're pretty much growing alongside them. At the same time, everything that we're going through, in some cases, they are too.
Sorry, I just was... This was quite good because, you know, I mean, there is always this thing of will you get too old for your part? Well, yeah, people play a lot younger than they actually are, you know, in real life. I mean, I don't think it's as big an issue as a lot of people, you know, make it out to be. So. You know what? That was really awful for me. That was tough. No, that was great. It was fantastic. And, I mean, I don't know if Katie's been in here saying, God, I hated doing the hugging scenes with Dan or something. But, I mean, for me, it was great fun.
I think all the characters have sort of grown up. It's a lot more sort of the teenage sort of life. Ron was a bit more sort of moodier in this one.
Yeah.
He has a few arguments and I enjoyed doing all that as well.
That was fun.
Now that you've all got a few films under your belt, can you talk a little bit about some of your favorite things? What do you splurge on? What are your luxuries? What are your favorite gadgets? Can each of you talk a little bit about that?
Group gadgets.
I really do like gadgets, yeah. I went to Japan last year, and that's a good place for them. I think at the moment, I'm not sure about gadgets at the moment, but...
Is that the camera thing? Remember when?
Oh yeah, when I went to Japan, I got this sort of spy camera, and it was like disguised as a cigarette box, and that was quite cool.
Put that in the AD's office, actually.
Probably my iPod. It comes on the air everywhere.
I find the iPod thing hard because I'm quite obsessive about CDs. And so I quite like to have the actual CD with the little sleeves and the back and the pictures and something, which some may call sad. I suppose for me it's mainly CDs, books, and DVDs, I suppose. I know that answer hasn't changed much in the last 5 years, so it's not really exciting, but I suppose that's the honest answer.
The three of you, Stephen Shaver here for the Boston Herald, the three of you are now part of this empire, this global phenomenon of Harry Potter movies, not just the books, and yet you've got such low-key profiles. I mean, you're not individually famous or anything like that. Now, is that all going to change now that you're real teenagers with hormones and everything? Are we going to see you turn into Lindsay Lohan and start trying to really, shock us with some stuff? And are you going to be party animal?
Hopefully not.
Well, I mean, I'm planning on buying 20 Porsches and crashing them all just for the extravagance. I don't think so. I mean, I think it's quite... I think it's a really good thing that we haven't... Because the characters are so well-known and iconic, if we had been going out and doing... Yeah, if we'd been... Basically, if we had gone to every party under the sun that we were invited to, it would have been hard for people to divorce what they see from in the film from what they see in magazines and stuff. And so I think that sort of would have been a mistake, and that's why we basically only go to the film.
I think we do have kind of a responsibility to that as well. I don't think... I don't think we are particularly party animals.
I quite enjoy the not having the high profile thing. I quite like that. I sort of feel like I'm fooling people. Because, you know, it's this massive thing, and yet it's still quite a low key thing. I feel like I'm tricking everyone.
I started new school 2 years ago, and at first you do get some funny looks, but after a while they just accept the fact that you're there all the time, and I didn't get treated any differently, and that's how I like it, so I like that pretty well.
Angela Dawson, Entertainment Newswire.
Shall I just quickly... Sorry, this is finishing the answer so far. Sorry. Thing that I would sort of... basically, when you get back to school, as Emma said, you know, originally when that person, you know, if you sort of running along with an extra arm or something, but then after a few weeks or something, it sort of settles down, and they just go, oh, there's a kid with the extra arm, you know, so it's like, it just doesn't seem to affect everyone quite as much. I mean, and it's actually, the only time it peaked is if I'm ever at school, I think it's only happened once, really, when I was at school when the third film came out, then it went a bit sort of fever pitch again, sort of mad. But I mean, it's not really a problem, generally. I mean, was it for you?
I've finished school now, so I don't really get the same sort of reaction as that. But getting recognised is sort of pretty weird, anyway. Obviously, I'm 17 now. Yeah. So I get the odd person sort of shouting out Ron or something. And my hair at the moment, I sort of stand out a bit, so I can't really afford it at the moment. But. Yeah, it's not really a problem.
Okay. Angela, again.
Sorry, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, you know, each of you kind of has kind of issues with each other going on throughout the film, and I thought it was kind of interesting kind of the fact that, you know, Rupert, you and Dan kind of get to be at odds a little bit, and there's kind of the tension, you know, with Emma and Rupert and stuff like that. And can you talk a little bit about kind of the kind of disconnect that kind of goes on, and how do you... guys, like when you come back to a new film, is it like going back to school?
I loved all the arguing. I thought it was really juicy. We've never, you know, always kind of always got along perfectly, and I think it's much more realistic that they would argue and that there would be problems. So I thought it was great fun. And I think it makes up for a lot of, as it's quite a dark book, this one, makes up for a lot of the humour, which is nice, it's a bit of a light relief.
What's quite nice, actually, about the thing that goes on between Harry and Ron in this one, in the tension, was that it was sort of, it's funny to someone looking in on it, but to them it's absolutely serious, and they're really angry at each other, and each of them feels they have both behaved in a really bad way, and like, sort of, they feel betrayed by them. It's mutual blame, both to blame for how they're acting with each other. But to someone else outside sort of watching it, it's quite funny, because you sort of, in the long run, it's actually quite trivial what they're arguing about. As a lot of sort of arguments are, you know, they seem really important at the time, and then 2 years later you can't even remember where it started or what it was about. So I think that was probably and as you said, it does provide a lot of the humour in that and me dribbling orange juice.
They both behave really...
Yeah. I enjoy doing that. Yes. Sorry.
I think it's also just sort of, again, just sort of them growing up, I think.
It's
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's sort of more natural, I suppose. Yeah.
I'd like to go back to what Emma was saying about this being quite a dark film. Mm-hmm. I also thought it's easily the funniest of the Harry Potter films. Was it difficult finding the balance of the tone when you were playing quite emotionally grueling stuff and then quite lighthearted?
I think it...
And you'd go on things
like... I think it was quite difficult because... I think it's difficult for them to know quite what to do because I think for... I mean, it's difficult because there's such a huge audience, which are children. You get such young kids being so into it. So part of the people who are making this film really feel, oh, we don't want to make it too scary because then we're going to cut out this huge audience who are so passionate and who love the Harry Potter films. At the same time, they want to be faithful to the book, which is a darker book. I think they did a really good balance because I really do think that it was faithful. And I think this one is darker and I think it's scarier. But I think that was the best way to go because from the very beginning, it's always been, we're going to stay faithful to what this is about and not about getting everyone and having huge audiences.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
I think it wouldn't have been so hard for us as for Steve Clovis who wrote the script. To adapt something as massive, just as huge as the fourth book is something that, I mean, I certainly wouldn't envy that task. I mean, he did an amazing job on it. I mean, to me, the humour's actually essential to the darkness in a way, because if you had that darkness running the whole way through the film, it would be, then you'd be tired and it would be completely ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you've got the humour, and what's quite nice is that might lull you into a false, you've got that quite dark opening with the snake and the caretaker being killed, but it then goes into the sort of this feel that's almost, it's like the first film, again, it's almost when the critics look up, it's all wide-eyed and it's full of wonder and everything, and that highlights the fact that suddenly they come out of the tent and everything's ablaze and everything's on fire, and which means the same thing as ablaze, so I don't know why I said both, and you know, so... And you suddenly instantly take it. It's more of a shock when you go into that darker world. So I think the humour is also sort of essential to that.
I don't think it's been, I don't think Mike has ever held us back in any way. He's always really, really pushed us. So that to make it so really real, how you would react in that sort of situation. He didn't sort of say, back down a bit. He really, really went for it. I mean, the other thing about Mike is that. He really, really treated us like adults. He wasn't taking any, you know, he was expecting us to be professional the whole time, whereas I think before, in some ways, I don't know, I just think...
We could get away with more.
Yeah, I think, yeah, but he really, there were no excuses, and he really pushed all of us, it was really nice to have, to feel that there was a real challenge.
Emma, there's, in the ball scene, there is a magical moment when you, stand at the top of a staircase and come down. How many times did you have to shoot it, and did you have input into your costume?
That actually took a while. I didn't know there were so many ways you could walk down stairs, actually, until that day. It was difficult. It was hard work because, you know, Mike was just giving me all these directions. Keep your head up, make sure... top of the back straight, but don't make it too clumpy, make sure that it glides smoothly, and by the time I did it, I was an absolute wreck, but hopefully it looks okay, and it kind of lives up to that amazing transformation, which it did for Hermione. As for the costume, I had a little bit of input, but I loved it so much anyway. There's nothing I really would have wanted to change about it. I mean, Gianni, who's head of our costume, created a truly magical dress. It's beautiful, beautiful. And there were loads of fittings for it throughout the whole, leading up to that ball scene. And I think that's great. No, I don't think it's upsetting. I don't know if you kept it, but no.
I got to swim, not in a dress, though. Which would have been good, in the slippers, yes. No, that was amazing. I mean, that was quite hard work, actually. Because, and it feels, I feel I could call what I did work. Because normally, I think I've got this thing in my mind that work can't be fun, because I always associate it with it not enjoying it. So, I've never associated Harry Potter with work in that way. But on these days, it was tough. I mean, it was fun, but it was hard, you know. And I trained for about sort of 6 months beforehand, and it was just I was going to them. What you did, I was sharing somebody else's air from their scuba diving tank, and I. So we both had sort of regulators, and then they say 3, 2, 1. On the 3, I would blow out all the air in my lungs, and then on the 1, I take a very big bubble of air in, and then sort of it's how much action you can do with that amount of breath in your body kind of thing. And it was actually quite, the hard thing was not just holding your breath, it was the fact that you couldn't, I wasn't actually allowed to let any of the air out, because Harry's supposed to become a fish with gills. I thought there's not supposed to be bubbles going around. So, if I look at all pained, but no, it was good fun. And I have to point out, I had the most amazing stunt team backing me up, who I trained with for all those 6 months, and who were down in the tank with me. So they were fantastic.
For each of you, now that it's been 4 films, what are your thoughts about whether acting is your long-term life choice, or don't you know yet?
Yeah, I think I'm really enjoying it at the moment, and doing all the Harry Potter films, it's a really good sort of experience. So I think I want to do it in the future, hopefully, as well, because I think it's not a bad job, so I think I want to continue with it, yeah, definitely.
I definitely wouldn't want Harry Potter to be the last thing I do, whether within this business it actually turns out to be film or not, because originally what I used to love was being on a stage and sort of reacting to a live audience. So maybe my calling is more in theatre, but I don't know. I'll see. There's so many different things you can do within it. I don't know why, but definitely looking around and definitely interested. Yeah.
I just love doing it, and I was trying to sort of work out the other day what's the attraction? Why do I love it so much? And I have no idea. I mean, the sort of conclusion I reached was that it was something to do with the idea of, I think maybe it's like a power thing, because you are sort of, you have a character, and in many ways, it's up to you how that character is perceived by people who are watching the film. It's obviously, it's not just up to you in terms of it in the script and the direction as well. So I suppose that's one of the things. I love doing it. I have a huge passion for acting, but also, I'm quite interested in maybe, I mean, I'm not even saying this will happen within the next 20, 30 years, but eventually maybe directing or something like that. Because simply because I've been so inspired by working with Chris Columbus and Alfonso and now Mike, and having conversations with David Yates, who's doing the 5th film, and also talking to Gary Oldman, because he directed his film Love by Mouth, which is a fantastic film. It's quite harrowing, but it's quite harrowing, but it's brilliant. And I mean, to talk to him about it, and he just said something which sort of is, when you're doing it, you're creating all the time, which is something that is quite appealing to me. So I think that a long way down the line, that's really.
Matthew Vines from veritaserum.com. Which scenes that you filmed that were cut would you most like to have seen in the final movie?
Good question. Difficult to say. It's kind of, I'm trying to think about what actually did get cut.
Yeah.
Because when it's all put into the final thing, it's so kind of, I don't know, it looks so, it all flows so well that you kind of forget what is actually missing. I'm just trying to think.
Personally, I was quite happy because all the bits I were worried about me being really bad and they cut, which was wonderful. What were some of the bits? There were just niggling sort of little moments where there was one moment just I went into the maze. There was another, and I just thought, oh, maybe that I didn't do as good as I could have done there, and they weren't in, which is fantastic. Which obviously means I was right. I hadn't done as well as I could have. But it was, so the stuff like, I can't actually think of whole scenes that were cut. The amount we shoot, there's a whole lot that did.
Yeah, a huge amount.
I think when you see the film, it does strike you as being so complete.
I can't remember.
Damn it, we're good.
Melanie Botney from Us Weekly magazine. Can you talk about
I'm going back to the theme of the parallels in the film to your own life. How much attention you will get from the opposite sex in your real life at school, and do you have boys chasing you and things like that?
Major. Sorry.
I don't really know how to answer that, to be honest. Dan, you're always good on this question. You take it.
Do I have boys chasing Anna? I don't. I mean, to be honest, I sort of. And you're talking about parallels in the film. There is a parallel in that both me and Harry are not very good with women. I think. I mean, I've got better now. I think. They used to be, I think. But I think any man ever who says he has never had an awkward moment with a girl is a liar. And if he does say that, he's either a liar or he's delusional, because he's sitting there thinking he's going along really well, and the girl is going, who is this man? Why is he still talking to me? So I think that's probably the main parallel with me and Harry in this film. I would like to say that I got huge amounts of attention, but I think that there's a sort of dividing thing between what people think they're going to get when they see the film, and then what the reality is. I think it's slightly grimmer, possibly. Yes. Nothing but.
Pretty much the same as Dan. Yeah, I don't. I'm probably very similar to Ron, really. He's not very lucky, and he has some bad experiences.
And the worst date in the world.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Some experience.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, that's what I quite like about the thing with Harry and Ron, is that they're the worst date in the world with these two poor girls. Because Ashan, the girl who plays Hannah, who has the misfortune of going out with Ron, is one of sort of my best friends. That's a button. I thought it was a microphone. Sorry, they're all here. And I thought it was just great, because you just feel so sorry, because this night should be the greatest night of the world in the world to feel, but it's horrible. And then you have that little bit outside, which is quite sort of true with those kind of dances type things, where you've got sort of the ballroom casualties who are outside weeping. Because the night has gone so horribly.
Hermione included.
Yes, included.
Hermione included. That's the thing, though. I think I loved doing it so much, because I could relate to so much of what she was going through. I so know that frustration where guys can just be so insensitive that she just wants to. She yells. I mean, she does yell. I can relate to a lot of the things that she experiences and all of her awkward moments. I'm feeling so unsure about. What's really sweet to think about the relationship that her and Victor have, and one that Mike really wanted to play to, is that Hermione is so insecure about herself, and she's never really had any attention from any guy before, that when she sees Victor looking at her, it's one of those kind of, is that guy really looking at me, or am I just, like, I don't think she, I mean, he genuinely wanted to come across as she is quite literally being swept off her feet. She doesn't know what's happening to her, and she gets caught up in this whirlwind that is this incredibly famous Quidditch player. I don't think she quite believes that it's happening to her. So, quite an emotional rollercoaster for her, but, I hope it looks good. It's
trade okay. Well, good job, countingdown.com. I wondered, if you're a bit older, which of the more mature roles in the series would you like to have played?
Serious, probably. I like, mainly because Gary Oldman played it, and I think he's one of the most brilliant actors. I think basically either way, Sirius is. Maybe actually I might have gone for a bit of an obvious one there, because Sirius is very similar to Harry, and it's what's sort of fascinating about, which would have been fascinating to me had I played Sirius, and which will be when I'm doing Harry, in the fifth film, is because it's sort of a relationship, and there are two such things basically in the fifth film. There are two relationships that are sort of based on mutual need for someone who's gone. So me and Sirius is basically. It's partly based on the fact that we like each other, and we're very close, but it's partly based on the fact that we both miss James, and he's sort of getting, he's clinging on to James through me, and I'm trying to get to know my father through him. And the same thing happened in a way with me and Cho Chang in the first film, when I was the last person there when her boyfriend Cedric got killed. And so we sort of have a crush on each other anyway, but it's also that thing. So I think for me, having played here, is that it would have been nice to look at Harry from another angle. So maybe when they do the remake in 50 years' time, I'll be lying upside down.
Rita Skeeter, because she's so deliciously evil. She is just, and she's such a personality, and I think she'd be so much fun to play, because she's funny, but there's also something very, very real about her, and her costume's fantastic.
Oh, we're in a room full of journalists.
Maybe that was the most important thing to say. I'm going to backtrack. Yeah, but...
What Emma meant...
was... No.
People have a malevolent side to them.
They can. Not always. But no, I think...
None of you.
None of you, any of him. But,
yeah. I don't know. I've always been Hagrid. He was pretty cool, yeah. Probably him. I don't know why he's... I don't know.
He's tall.
He's tall, yeah. That's, that's good one reason.
We have time for two more questions in the room, then we'll go to the phone.
Could each of you just go through who your favorite actors are who are not in the film, and then maybe who each of your favorite bands are or musician?
Okay, yeah. Root, do you
want to go first? Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm quite into the comedy films mainly, and I don't know. When I was younger, I always liked Jim Carrey, I quite liked. And I had Dumb and Dumber in that, and quite Mike Myers as well, because. Yeah, I like Shrek, and, yeah, maybe them. Yeah.
Music?
Music, yeah. I'm into sort of rock. AC/DC are quite cool, I like them. Yeah.
And? This question's always such a killer, I hate it.
Look what you've done.
I'm so sorry. Just because there's so many people, it's really... I've never really had one person that I particularly idolised, or that I thought, wow, I want to be just like them. But I used to be, when I was younger, Julia Roberts. I used to just love her. Just, I don't know, there's something so appealing about her. And I think, probably more recently, I've loved what Natalie Portman has, I mean, not just on screen, but as herself, how she's handled herself. I think she's done a really good job. I love people like Renee Zellweger, who aren't afraid to... They're kind of attractive and really put themselves into a character role, and, you know, to really be an actress instead of just thinking about, oh, am I sitting on screen pouting and looking beautiful all the time, because that's really not what it's about. I thought Nicole Kidman's had a fantastic career. She's done so different things with her. Like, she's been really successful. I think she's done some great things. I could go on forever. Okay, music. This, again, is very difficult because I like so many different things. I've got so many different music influences on my life. My dad has got quite a big influence on that. He's got me into Eric Clapton, B.B. King, loads and loads of stuff like that. And then my mum, Pretenders, Tina Turner, Elvis Presley, that kind of thing as well. And then me, for myself, I kind of, there's a bit of a divide between what kind of music I like. Music that I like to dance to, so like I'm really, really into hip hop at the moment. And then there's things that I just like listening to. I love Damien Rice. I just love music generally. Whenever you come into any room in my house, I always have music playing. Everything basically.
In a way, it's quite hard to think of actors that I want to work with that we haven't. We've been incredibly lucky, really. I mean, worked with sort of the best British actors of their generation, really. I mean, David Thewlis and Gary Oldman, now Ralph Fiennes, Brendan Gleeson, Michael Gambon. So, I mean, it's really sort of insane who we've worked with. It's amazing. Other actors that I would like to work with, I actually think you said Natalie Portman. She's just a fantastic actress, and also beautiful, which is also a plus if you're going to work with someone. And then what? I'm trying to think of other actors that are. There's a German actor who I think is absolutely amazing. I mean, I don't know if it would ever work, because I don't speak German, but Daniel Brühl, who's in The Educators, I don't know if you saw The Educators, and he was in Goodbye Lenin as well, and he's amazing. When I sponsored each of my 1:10 p.m., Gael García Bernal is amazing. And I only name it. Come on now, think of someone who speaks English. I can't actually think. I mean, To be honest, I would have liked the older actors that I sort of really look up to, just for how they were, Peter Sellers. Because when people talk about classic British actors, you talk about like Laurence Olivier and things, but Peter Sellers did the most amazing films, like being there, and Dr. Strangelove, he played, I think, four parts in, or something, is it four or three? Three. I can't, and so he's just amazing. But I mean, with music, that's comes easier to me, which is possibly not the right way around, it should be, but I got an album the other day by a band called We Are Scientists, a band called, yes, good, it's so rare that my taste gets recognition from someone, that's a very special moment, fantastic, who else at the moment, The Rakes, Dogs, Hard-Fi, but I'm also sort of listening to a lot of they're not similar in actual. New Franz Ferdinand album is extraordinary, it's brilliant, but they all sound sort of that kind of indie, but I also like sort of more orchestral type, like God's, yes, anyone heard? Okay, hands up if you've heard of a band called Godspeed You Black Emperor. Yes, fantastic. Brilliant. My dad got me into sort of David Bowie and T-Rex and stuff like that. Yes, Electric Warrior. What a brilliant album! When we were in San Francisco, he bought Melanie's Greatest Hits. It's brilliant. It's absolutely fantastic. There's one song called Look What They've Done to My Mama. It's fantastic. So those are probably sort of some of the ones at the moment.
It's very quick. It's Thomasina Gibson, and I'm with Sci-Fi Wire. I know it's very difficult, but what memory will you of this film carry away with you when you are sort of lying in bed and you're on your own and you're thinking, "Oh my God, that was brilliant." Which memory will it be?
Seeing it, probably. When you see sort of 11 months of your life and, you go in every day and you do it, and it's like, because it's a very, particularly with Harry Potter, it's a very gradual process. And because it's so huge, and you piece it together day by day and you refine and refine and refine and go through all the different stages. And there's 15 minutes of credits. Thousands of people work on it. So all whose work is as important as the last. And then it amounts to this massive thing at the end of it, which is just amazing, and it's a fantastic thing to see, because, I believe we've made a great film, a really good film. Even if we hadn't, the sense of achievement would still be this amazing thing. So that would probably be, for me, about the film.
My answer's quite similar, Sam. You kind of think that working on something for 5 years, I've been doing this for, the novelty would start to wear off, and does get a bit boring, you probably start to get a bit complacent and want to move on and stuff. But a couple of weeks back, the trailer showed for the first time on ITV News. And I remember coming in to the kitchen, and it was on the screen, and it said it's going to play in 5 minutes. And I literally just filled with excitement all over again about the fact that I was part of it, and that I was in it, and that I could be excited about it, and it's all starting again, and I was going to see it soon, and all the waiting, and when I saw it, I was literally just like, I was so excited again, and probably sort of starting to see it all come out, because
I mean, there's a huge wait. I mean, a candle wait. You've worked on a film for 11 months, and then you have to wait 6 months to see it. And it's a painful. You just so want to just know what it looks like. And
I find it hard to actually even remember anything, really, from the quite a long ago. So I'd have to say, seeing it at the end, it was
the end product.
Yeah, definitely.
It's far too early to be reminiscing, though. I think we're all going to sound like far too soon. But it's quite a nice question to end that
And now we're going to go to some questions from our phone in folks. So, operator, first question.
First question comes from the line of Paige Banfield of danradcliffe.co.uk. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dan. My question is for you. What is
Paige.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. What is the one impression of this film that you wish that the viewers would take away that perhaps they didn't get from the first three films?
I think the main theme of the entire, sort of like a story arc, you get the first, it comes across in this film more than it has in the last one, the whole series is about a loss of innocence. And I mean, from going in the first one where it's all sort of very wide-eyed and almost naive, where, you know, he's quite naive and thinking because it's a magical world, it's going to be better than the world that he's come from. Whereas in actual fact, it's not. It's actually got, there are further extremes. I mean, the furthest apart, you know, it can have extremes of joy which possibly are more than in the normal human world, but also the depths that man can sink to in people like Voldemort is, and I think in this film he starts to wake up to that fact even more than in the last one. And I think he comes to the realization that if he's going to make it in life, he's going to be making it alone. And I think that's probably the main thing that he experiences, that he sort of discovers in this film, and hopefully people will realise without me telling, you know, without reading that.
Okay, so operator, second question.
Second question comes from a line of Lisa Carlin of CBS Radio. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Congratulations to all of you. It's a wonderful movie. And I'd love to hear each of you answer this question. After all these years, I'm sure you're incredibly invested in these characters and the story. J.K. Rowling is writing the seventh book now, the final book. If there was something you could say to her that you either really want to happen or really don't want to happen before this series is finished, what would it be?
If Quidditch isn't absolutely necessary... maybe don't, because I read in an interview, with her a while ago saying, she said something like, it's become quite a chore writing Quidditch now. It's quite tough to film, you know, it's tough on both of us. No one's benefiting. So maybe that would probably be what I would say. But then again, you know, it is also... It's incredibly exciting for people to watch, so there is that as well. So, yeah.
And how about Emma and Rupert?
I'm going to make Rupert really uncomfortable now. For goodness sake, Hermione and Ron just need to get it together. This has been so long now. And they're so wrong, but they're so right, and it just needs to happen, and they just need to get on with it. And yeah, if that doesn't happen, I'm going to be really frustrated. Like, oh, God, it's still ongoing. So hopefully they will end up together.
Great answer.
Not a little bit different. I was actually looking forward to Quidditch, really, and sort of ruined it for
me. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, operator, question 3.
One moment. Next question comes from a line of Sharon Eberson of Pittsburgh Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, how are you guys doing? I was wondering, you said that on this film, Mike Newell treated you as adults, and perhaps that hadn't been the case before or as much so before. In what way did that manifest itself? How did you know that, we're being taken seriously and more like adults this time around?
anybody where you say something I'm still thinking.
I don't know. I suppose it's just the way that, I mean, Alfonso put a lot of trust in us, and it was so nice that he really wanted to hear what we had to say and what we thought, because that Mike kind of took it to a new level. He just, I mean, sometimes I think I'd be saying to him, I'd be doing something really difficult, and I'd just say, I can't get this right. Just tell me what you want me to do. Just tell me how you want this to be, because I'm going crazy. And he'd just say, I can't tell you how to do it. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. And I'd be like, okay. He just said, just think about it. I mean, it was just nice that while he guided us really well, we felt responsibility for ourselves, for our role, for how we came across, and he put a lot of trust in us to do that, and it was really, really nice.
I mean, I suppose sort of the main thing that I got out of Mike's direction was that, you know, we're now old enough to appreciate, you know, scenes being analyzed and broken down. And the fact is, you know, there is such a rigorous process of drafting the script on Harry Potter, on all films. On Harry Potter, you know, we must go through about seven before we get to the one we start shooting on. And so basically by that time, if it is in the script, it pushes the story forward and it advances things. And it is there for a reason. And Mike was fantastic at going into detail about, I mean, I remember the first sort of the first time we were rehearsing with Mike, he went, it was me and Matt Lewis, the boy who plays Neville, who's fantastic. He's just the greatest guy. And we were doing the scene, and on the page, the scene was around an inch and a half long. And we spent about an hour and a quarter rehearsing it and going through different, and we were sort of going, right, if this is how long a scene and a half, you know, inch and a half a script takes, how long will it be when we get to the 12-page things with Voldemort? But, you know, I mean, but we were sort of slightly apprehensive about how we were going to be pushed, but it was very exciting. And, I mean, we sort of, he realised that we are now old enough to appreciate really going into detail with us about the scenes. And I think that was probably the main thing that changed in this film.
Yeah, same really, and I think I finished school now, and so for me it feels like I'm sort of growing up a bit more now anyway, so yeah, and but Mike was great, and he was sort of really into sort of like your own sort of input, and we would, yeah, like sort of uniform and that, but yeah, definitely.
Okay, operator, we have time for one more question.
Your next question comes from the line of Earl Dittman of Wireless Magazine. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys and girls. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. You've just been greeted by two members of the audience.
I got the final question. Well, one thing, two-part question. Now that you've played these characters for over four films, do you feel like a connection to them, like twins or best friends? And are you excited about doing the rest of the films, the rest of the books? For all of you.
Dan, do you want to go first?
I'm hugely attached to Hermione's character because they're so... I've been denying it for the past 4 years. I know any of you who interviewed me earlier on, but there is so much of me that goes into her, and so much of my experiences and one of the things Mike did is he made me think about it not as acting, but as kind of regurgitating my own experiences and sort of putting them into weird way of saying that. But yeah, no, putting them into, like applying them to what Hermione was going through. So I know that if anybody else played Hermione, it would actually kill me. I wouldn't be able to, deal with it at all. No. I'd go after her. Anyway, so yeah, not do you feel too close to her?
Threat to any future Hermione.
Yeah, watch out.
No, but that was actually a very good way of putting it. It was sort of, not particularly pretty image at first. But no, you're absolutely right. He did make us draw upon our experiences. I think you can't
really help but feel attached to certainly I can't help but feel attached to him in some ways. But I mean, I don't know about twins, but I mean it's but I think, oh, someone's tape's just run out. I just thought I'd point that out. But I don't know if it's so much that. In a way, I don't know if me playing him has turned out how much I am like him now, or you know, being so close to him over 5 years has influenced my own character. I mean, I don't think it's. I mean, I'm going to develop a complex over it or anything, but I mean, it's a sort of slightly interesting thing. I mean, it's very hard to separate yourself from him in some ways, but ultimately. You go home at night, and you're not like you stay in character all the time. It would be very hard to be a method actor on Harry Potter, because then you'd have to try and find the figure of ultimate evil somewhere. And I don't exist.
Rupert, you've broken the mystery.
sorry, that wasn't a part of the answer to the question. You don't have to put that bit in. But yes, so that will be my not particularly clear answer to that question. Oh, that was the other part. Yes, sorry. I mean, ultimately it comes down to the fact that are we still all enjoying it? I mean, if we are, sorry, I'm just laughing a minute thing. If we are, then I think it would be sort of stupid not to, as long as, you know, if the script's good and it's a challenge and it's an interesting director, and as long as, I mean, I speak for myself, I'm not going to pretend I'm speaking for everyone here, you know, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I would feel that as long as I'm doing sort of enough other stuff, for some reason I keep addressing all the phone questions to you on those, as long as I'm doing enough sort of other stuff at around the same time, then I think it would be, and also, to be honest, I sort of try to read the books when they come out very impartially and not making up my mind. But the fact is, when I was reading the fifth book, there was bits, and I was going, God, I would love to do that. It's so good. Yeah, so, yeah, that's...
Do you read those books earlier than the
last? Oh, no. This is what... I tell my friends I know, and then make up stories. And so, but I don't actually get... No, that's not...
Yeah, well, from the beginning, I've always felt I could sort of relate to Ron. In some little way, like both ginger one. Both got sort of big families, and I've always sort of, obviously sort of playing them for quite a long time. You sort of get to know them, I suppose, and yeah. As for in the future, I'm really looking forward to all the next ones, I think. So yeah, definitely.
Great.
I think it's really difficult when people ask these questions, because. It's such a huge commitment. I don't think anyone can appreciate, unless you're honest, the amount of time everything takes. And 11-month film is huge. And it's not just, you know, a little bit every day. It's a full day. We work hours. And so, you know, I think I would never want to do it if I felt, you know, I wasn't going to give it 100%. I'm so sort of focused on this one now, and I'm so excited about this film now. I'm not really thinking about anything future at all, and you just got to take it one at a time, because otherwise you just get a little bit overwhelmed, I think.
I'm not in any way trying to undermine. We don't, just in case we get prosecuted, we don't actually work 4 adult hours. We work very long hours, and when we're not, but I mean, I think what makes it harder than, I think a lot of actors. Exactly, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it basically comes to the equivalent, because when we're not filming, when most adult actors are not filming, they just sort of go to death and relax. Whereas with us, we go to
work.
So, yeah, I just thought I'd...
And that is...
Can't wait for still time.
Well, congratulations again for a great movie.
Thank you very, very much.
On that note, we have to spirit them on out of here, so thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.